Welcome to Two-Way Street. Today we're going to talk to three powerful, immensely successful, and fiercely proud women. Monica Pearson, Deneen Milner, and Christine White. They have a number of things in common. First, that they're all African American. Second, they share a set of challenges that are well known to many black women. And third, they're the stars of a new TV show here on GPB television called A Seat at the Table, which premieres this weekend, Sunday night. I should say, by the way, that we are recording this show in front of a live audience of women who really want to hear what you have to say. Now, I'm a white guy. If you don't know that, I am. So, you know, I see the world through the lens of whiteness. I can't help that. But I don't think that makes it any less important for me to try to understand how other people experience life. And that's why I'm excited about talking to you all on our show today. Deneen Milner, you are a New York Times bestselling author. You've published, like, what, 27 books?
27, yes. Whew.
You've written for a number of top magazines, Red Book, Essence, Family Circle, others, yes?
Yes, yes.
And you've been a frequent guest on national TV shows. And a lot of the time, you've been called on to talk about issues like mothering and parenting and children's issues, that sort of thing.
Sure. Right? My background is as a, well, I started as a political reporter and then went over to entertainment and then found my way into Parenting Magazine and worked for Parenting Magazine for about 4 years as their toy editor. So I was like the real version of like Big. I tested toys and got moms all over the country to test these toys out with kids. But I also edited the feature section, some cover stories, and the ages and stages development section in the back of the magazine. For a majority of the time that I was working there, I was the only African-American from the person, top person down to the person who cleaned the toilets.
We're going to talk a bit about that during the show today.
Yeah. So,
Christine White is an attorney. You have a background, though, in the entertainment industry, right?
Absolutely. I started actually as a high schooler, handing out flyers and little CDs, little mixtapes for rappers in Atlanta and Decatur. And then went on to work at Def Jam and work in the music industry in Atlanta, and found that my skill set wasn't as great as I needed it to be. So I went to law school and then found that that wasn't exactly what I needed. It wasn't all the tools I needed. So then I went to Georgia Tech and got an MBA. And so now I am sort of all things strategy and business for entertainers and people in media.
Okay, thank you. Monica Pearson, if you live in the anywhere in the North Georgia area, you've known Monica Pearson for a long time. She started as the principal female anchor at Channel 2 News back in 1975.
That's correct.
Came in from Louisville, Kentucky.
And you said it right, Louisville. The former newspaper reporter for the Louisville Times, worked in public relations for Brown-Forman Distillers. Then went from one family operation to another, you know, from the Bingham family, which owned the newspaper and the TV station, WHAS, and then went to work for the Brown family at Brown-Forman Distillers, and then came to Cox, and 37 years later, you know, I retired.
Retired after 37 years, but clearly you are continuing. You've got a radio show of your own.
I have a radio show on KISS every Sunday where I get to do great R&B music and do talk about issues that normally I wouldn't be able to do. And then I think the fun thing is doing this show.
Okay.
I'm having fun doing this as a retiree.
A Seat at the Table. The title of the show comes from a quote by former U.S. representative and presidential candidate back in 1972, Shirley Chisholm.
Yeah.
What was the quote?
If they don't give you a seat at the table, bring a folding chair.
Right. Right.
If you don't mind, I have another quote that I'd like to use to spark our conversation.
Sure.
Harriet Tubman. Harriet Tubman, who, of course, was a great activist as far back as the middle of the 19th century, African-American activist. Here's what she said. She said, "In my mind, I see a line. And over that line, I see green fields and lovely flowers and beautiful white women with their arms stretched out to me over that line. But I can't seem to get there no how. I can't seem to get over that line. It strikes me that in many ways, that statement, after having gotten a chance to watch three of your shows, says a lot about what you try to deal with on your show. Fair enough?
Sure, absolutely. You know, sometimes that line, you would think that a line is very simple and it's easy to step over, but sometimes that line feels like a glass wall. Like you can't walk through a glass wall. There's a line, but there's this wall that that I didn't put there, that Monica didn't put there, Christine didn't put there, but it's there nonetheless. And so the question is, do you try to break through that glass wall, or do you stand on your side and you understand that there's joy on your side of the line?
Interesting.
And I think that I tend to float more toward the latter, and that is because I tried to burst through that wall for so long. I'm almost 50 years old. And trying to burst through that wall in my career, just it's tiring, it's exhausting.
Yeah.
And so I've just found that as I've gotten older, I find my joy in the way that I feel like finding my joy. And sometimes that involves turning away from that line and creating my joy on the side of the wall.
So Monica, now, let me.
I was going to say about the line.
But I've got a question for you. But go ahead.
Well, what I was going to say about the line is, when I was growing up, the line was very real. Because we were living in a very segregated society. I grew up with the colored signs. I grew up using the colored water fountains. I grew up riding in the back of the bus
in
Louisville, Kentucky.
Right.
Because I didn't go to my first integrated school until I was in the third grade. So the line was very clear for me based on race versus based on being female. I came into my own when my mother hocked her engagement ring, which I wear all the time, and paid for me to go to an all-girls Catholic high school because she was determined that if I was going to make it to the next level, I was going to have to be in an integrated society of women who were white. Because I was going to have to live and work in that world. And she had been a maid, so she saw all the negativity. She was determined that I was going to be just as smart, but that I would have street sense as well as in-house sense.
You know,
so that line for me has moved, but I've also learned there are women on the other side who I call friends, who I have touched, our hands have reached, we have touched. And we talk about things that most black and white women don't talk about, but I can only do that with a very few.
So let me, I'm glad you talked about that, but here's the question I really wanted to ask you about. So we said already, you came to Atlanta in 1975 to be the principal female anchor on Channel 2 News. Now we should point out that 1975 was just 4 years after Lester Maddox left as governor of Georgia, and the climate had not changed dramatically in those 4 years. Carter was now governor, but he had been a seg candidate the first time. So, I mean, the point is, you came into a segregated environment, and you had to, from the very start, deal with what it meant.
I still say, if there had been social media at that time, I probably would not have made it, because people have ready access to you and can say anything. And now so many TV stations, radio stations go completely by what the public's reaction is to you. But I was blessed in that I had black women already at the station who were very supportive, who were looked over for the job, but who still said, we want you to succeed. And then I had John Pruitt, white male who'd been on the air forever, who said, I want you to have an opportunity. And he was the buffer between me and that part of society, both black and white. Black people said I wasn't black enough. They wanted me in a fro out to here. White people said I was too black. And it was because of that family, and that's the only way to describe it, a general manager who said, I'm going to take the chance because I'm looking at the population of Atlanta. But in the same vein, I knew if I didn't do well, it would be a long time before anybody else did. I was underpaid. I knew that. Over the years, male anchors were given opportunities that I was not given. until after I had been there long enough and proven that I was the money chip.
You endured some pretty difficult times,
I
though.
Did.
There wasn't social media, but there were letters, there were phone calls from racists who were appalled that you were on the air at Channel 2.
But you know the way I got around it, and you know this. I used to do more speeches and public appearances than anybody.
That's right.
And I learned that by going into those communities, I remember doing the first Black History program in Villa Rica. By going into those communities, even people who didn't want you there, you either charmed them or they left you alone because they thought, if you're here, you got to be crazy. And the best story of my career is this. When you came back, from a Klan rally.
That's right.
And the Klan guy told you what?
We were in Forsyth County.
Forsyth.
There are a great many people who will remember that there was a big march in Forsyth County. It was one of the biggest, civil rights marches of the second half of the 20th century.
Oprah even
thousands
came to one.
Of people, right, Oprah came down. Mm-hmm. And there were like 20,000 people who marched, and I went up there for Channel 2, and a guy from the Klan, we were greeted with signs. I was a reporter, but the marchers were greeted with signs with the worst language imaginable on them, the N-word. But a Klan guy came up to me and said, "You're Bill Nugent from Channel 2. Do you know Monica Kaufman? I love you."
Lord.
All right. So
weird.
All right.
That's so weird.
Monica's...
Isn't that hilarious? But we reached across the line because in my case, I made myself accessible to all of those communities where there were not Black people.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was not always easy, but you do it for that reason, to open up the door for somebody else.
And, of course, we all know you went on to become the one of the great anchors. You got underpaid at first. By the end of your career, Channel 2...
I made up for it.
Channel 2 would essentially bring a dump truck up to your front lawn
yes.
and pour money out and say, please stay for another couple of years. Do you two have stories that... Are moments in history when you were able, as Monica did, to change the equation just a bit? Is that a fair question?
So I remember one time specifically working at the Daily News. Again, I started out as a political reporter and then got tired of seeing that sausage being made and went and became an entertainment reporter. And I decided to focus specifically on African Americans entertainment because nobody was covering them. So if Jay-Z had a new album out, I was the one who covered it. And the Daily News at the time was the sixth largest newspaper in the country. Mm. And we were in the middle of New York City, a city with how many people of color reading this newspaper that had 6 million people a day reading it? And so it didn't make sense to me that we weren't covering Halle Berry and Denzel Washington and The Best Man and Love Jones and, Terry McMillan's books. It didn't make sense to me. And so I decided to do it. And my work earned me spots on television. I was hosting radio. I was talking on MSNBC and CNN. And I couldn't get a promotion at my job. As a matter of fact, a young guy who had been hired to be my boss. I had been there by then probably about 8 years, and a young guy came in and he took my story, my profile of Jay-Z, and sort of marked it up and, tried to tell me how to write a profile, 8 years in at the Daily News. And there was this one section in the story about Jay-Z, when he got upset, he would get in his old Lexus and drive around Brooklyn listening to A Song for You by Donny Hathaway. And right? And so he opened, he big red marker across Donny Hathaway and says, "Who's Donny Hathaway?" Right. What you mean, who's Donny Hathaway? And so I lost it. I quit 2 days later.
Really?
I did. Because I found, maybe about a year before that, there was a woman who was hired as the editor-in-chief of the newspaper, the first time ever. And she came in, and within a couple of weeks, she called me into her office, and she says, "If you tell anybody I told you this, I will fire you on the spot. But everyone around you, all the men around you, are making $20,000 more than you are." and they've been getting Christmas bonuses. And I was like, Christmas bonuses? Thank you about Christmas bonuses?
Christine, you're nodding. You're nodding. You know that experience?
You know, I think I kind of had the reverse experience. I had an experience kind of growing up not feeling very different, or not knowing that it, when I did feel different, it was sort of, there was some race overtones. You know, being on the playground and having all of the girls in a mostly white environment, you know, all ask each other about what boys they liked and the things that, you know, that sort of made socializing as a young person palatable. And then, of course, you know, being overlooked in that conversation as if I can't have a crush or something, you know, or that my feelings weren't relevant. And, you know, these are the little things that happen that you don't, you know, understand that it's weird, but you don't know what to call it. There was a time when I then realized here at Avondale in Atlanta, at Avondale High School, where it occurred to me that I actually had to fight. I had to bring my grades to the administrator and tell them I should be in the AP classes. I found out somehow, and I don't even remember how, that if you had a certain score, you would be in the advanced or AP classes. So I had to bring that attention to my administrator. But the interesting thing was my girlfriend, Jakeitha Nipper, who's living in Canton now, actually, had higher scores than me and was stereotypically, culturally, I was from California. I had a mother who was a grandmother who was a librarian. I spoke the King's English. I had a way about me that made white people very comfortable. She was from the hood. She had a way about her that made white people very uncomfortable. And they refused to put her in the advanced class. Hmm.
All right.
That's still happening, by the way.
It still happens.
Happens. Okay, we got to get to a break. So these are experiences about challenges you face that we're sort of familiar with in a broad way. We understand that minorities, African-American women, black men, Hispanics in some cases, we know that there is prejudice that you have to overcome. But when we come back, I want to dig into the heart of what your show is really all about. I want you to pull back the curtain. Sure. And share with us some of the issues that you talk about on the show and that relate to things that only African-American women really understand they have to deal with. Fair enough?
Yeah, fair enough.
All right. Let's take a break right now. And when we come back, more of Two Way Street with women from Seat at the Table. Welcome back to Two Way Street. We have a great show today. We're talking to the women who star in the new GPB TV show called A Seat at the Table. Monica Pearson, one of them, Deneen Milner, and Christine White are all with us. And by the way, we're recording the show on the set of A Seat at the Table, which premieres on Sunday night here on GPB TV. And we're recording the show in front of a powerful group of women, some of whom share your experiences in different ways than you do, but I think who understand what it means to try to make your way as a woman in the world today. Okay, I really want to dig in. I watched about three or four of your shows.
Yay!
And I learned some stuff.
Yes!
I want to read you another quote. Ruby Dee. Mm. Ruby Dee said, "The kind of beauty I want most is the hard-to-get kind that comes from within, strength, courage, dignity." And I wanted to read that quote because I thought it was really, it's fascinating to talk about black women and appearance. Monica, I've known you for more than 20 years, and during the 20 years that I was with you at Channel 2, you came in with a different hairstyle about once a week, and management was never quite sure what to make of that, and at times you got a lot of grief for it. Excuse me. I apologize. But the fact is, hair is a real issue for African-American women, isn't it?
I love the quote. Which of you said about hair?
Hair is to black women what weight is to white women.
Oh.
And so if you need a reference point for obsession, black women obsess about their hair and shame each other, I think, to a certain degree about hair. And then the media also takes on a role of sort of shaming us on our hair. In the same way that I think that a lot of my white girlfriends experience being shamed about their weight or their size or their curves. That is an experience.
Why is it an issue? What is the issue?
Well, it's been an issue forever and ever, amen, because there is this picture of beauty, quote unquote, mm-hmm. and that beauty doesn't look like us. That beauty looks like the white woman with long, straight hair. And, you know, most women who cut off their hair, white women too, their husbands are going, why'd you cut off your hair? Yeah. You know, but, you know, a woman's hair is her crowning glory. And you have to be able to flip it and all of that. And so, you know, there was even a time in New Orleans where black women who wore their beautiful hair in braids and locks, that because it attracted white men, they actually passed a law that said, you know, you must cover your head. And that's when we came up with the gaylis and the scarves. Mm-hmm. It is an issue because even since we were brought over, we were not thought of as beautiful with our natural hair.
Is it also an issue because in many cases, you know, I've been realizing there are so many ways I can get myself in trouble having this conversation. But allow me to plunge in.
Please,
is it also an issue because in some ways, typically, African-American hair is harder to work with than
white
people? That's a myth.
You know, you sound like...
I told you I could get in trouble.
No, but I know why you say that, because any hair is difficult to work with.
Right.
You ask a woman with real straight hair, and she's spending hours and hours trying to curl it and get
perms. Okay, fair enough.
However, to your point, there were no norms. There were no norms adopted for how to... keep black hair healthy.
Right.
So while there was tons, millions and billions of dollars gone into research on the different types of shampoos that white women should use, white men should use, the research that went into the need, I mean, our hair is just chemically different. So the moisture content is different. So no, once you know about your hair, which is like a whole revolution that's happening right now. Black women are experimenting with products. Product companies are investing money in determining what products work for our hair. But you do one thing if we use the same products that white people use, our hair would either fall out, it would crack.
But there are white women who use our products because their hair is extremely curly and tight. But it goes back to the very beginning where we were not treasured. We were not seen as beautiful for the darkness of our skins, for the roundness of our hips, for the bigness of our lips, and for our hair having a tight natural curl. So when you started having the interracial sex and you end up with black people who are fair with long straight hair, then that becomes the symbol of beauty. So the young woman who doesn't have that is told, you know, maybe you need to bleach your skin, maybe you need to do a perm. Why do you think Madam C.J. Walker became so
rich
helping black women straighten their hair?
But
because
I think
they wanted to look that way.
But I think what's awesome that's going on right now in this moment, in this here and now, is that there are a bunch of black-owned companies, women, who are taking in the footsteps of Madam C.J. Walker and creating products that we can use in our hair. Now, I've been natural for 19 years.
Yeah, I was going to just point that out. We're going to show some. We'll have some photographs of all of you on the Two-Way Street website.
Right.
And
20 years for me.
Yeah.
And when people watch the show, they'll see that you are the one of the three who wears your hair in braids.
And
locks.
Locks. And you embrace it.
Absolutely.
Clearly.
Absolutely.
Because You look beautiful.
Well, thank you. And I think that my hair in its natural state is exactly the way it should be.
But,
the way
but
that it grows
it
out of my head.
For you, out in the
she
world?
She works for herself.
There's a reason why I work for myself.
She works for herself. Now, had I shown up with WSB like that, no matter how much they loved me, they would have sent me right out and said, get a wig.
Right,
I think it's
right,
gorgeous.
Right, thank you. But the crazy part is that when I did work in an office, when I worked at Parenting Magazine, the white women there loved my hair. But when I were, it was the black women that saw me with an afro and had a problem with me walking around with, why are you walking around with your hair looking
issue,
like that?
The question that you posed is an interesting one because it is difficult to make black hair look like white hair.
Right.
That's the difficulty.
Right.
And so for so long, we've been trying to make black hair appear and mimic the way that white hair naturally, it looks in its natural state.
When I hear you say that, that seems heartbreaking to me.
It is heartbreaking.
It's so hard to make black hair.
Imagine standing in a mirror and that happening, or sitting in my case in my kitchen chair, my dad trying to make my hair.
Think about your daughter.
Look like that.
How heartbreaking is it for to tell your child to have your child come to you at 5 and say, "Mommy, why can't I have hair like Sally Mae? Why can't I have hair like Krista at school?" That is.
Right, it's painful.
It's heart-wrenching for my beautiful little girl to think that she's not good enough because she cannot mimic in her natural state what she sees in the dolls on television, not just the girls at her school, but everywhere around her, the images of beauty and womanhood. And little girls are looking for ways to become more womanly all the time. They're trying to find, you know, ways that they can become mature women. And one of the marks of beauty is the length and the way that your hair comes out of your head.
And that is precisely why I went natural, because I have two little girls, and the last thing I wanted, the person that they see every day they open their eyes is their mother. And I wanted them to see my hair the way that it grows out of my head so they would be comfortable with their hair the way it grows out
and
of their head.
And Claire has known me in so many different hairdos, but the thing is that Claire really appreciates, you know, all of my hairdos. But the point is that the natural is most comfortable for me, which is the reason I don't color my hair. It's my fight against people who say, well, you need to put some color in your hair. It makes you look old. Or, oh, you look like your husband's, you know, mother. And I go, no, she's light skinned with red hair, you know. But Bill, your curls.
Yeah.
You got curls.
Yeah. When I was in high school, I didn't have curls. My hair was kinky. Mm. And it really, I hated it.
Bothered you.
And I used to. I lived in Chicago, grew up there. I had to go down to the south side of Chicago to black drugstores and buy
get the product,
the straightener product, because they didn't sell it in white drugstores.
Right.
And by the way, it didn't work. But all right, let's go to another part of the aspect of beauty. And you look, we're on public radio, you're on public TV, so we can talk about women's butts.
Yes, we can, and we do.
We can talk about women's booties.
Yes.
Power to the booty.
How's that going these days?
Well, you know what irritates me is that for years, all three of us were probably, I know I was teased as a little girl about having a butt. My mother used to say, you know, hold that in. Quit tooting out your butt. And then my mother's best friend, Miss Mary, said, Hattie, she's not tooting out her butt. That's just the way she's built. And, you know, but I get so furious now when I read about young women getting butt implants who are African-American women because they want to have a butt and a figure like Kim Kardashian's.
It astounds me.
It
astounds me. Because I grew up in Long Island, New York. I couldn't fit into Jordache jeans if you held a gun to my head and a bucket of money in front of my face. I could not get in them because my body was not shaped like that. And so that was torture to me. No one appreciated the Coke bottle figure. And now, because of people like Kim Gardner, when you see black women's features presented on white women, now all of a sudden it's okay.
It's okay.
And that drives me crazy. Because we've been here, we've been shaped like this, and you know, dependent. If I would have grown up in Brooklyn or Oakland, I'd have got some play.
But we now have rappers who celebrate booty. I mean,
well, they were back in the day.
Yeah.
Think about Sir Mix-a-Lot and the way that he did LL Cool J. You listen to some of the lyrics back in the day, and they did talk about black women's bodies and the way that we're shaped, but the way that the images were portrayed in the videos by mainly white directors and models being serviced by white-owned companies, they still sort of fit into that pop cultural ideal that did not look like black women. And so what you ultimately had was people thinking that hip-hop didn't appreciate black women, and it was Outkast that changed that.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it was Outkast that changed that by featuring Buffy the Body.
Yes.
In one of their videos, and then all of a sudden it was like, oh, okay, we can come out and look like we really look?
All right.
That's
so
cool.
Okay, so we could talk about body image for a while, but we're going to move on. But before we do, should we say that things have changed so you can be more comfortable as the person you are looking the way you are today?
No.
Then, no?
No. No.
I think it has.
Well, I don't have anything to compare it to. I mean, I always knew that there weren't clothes made for me. So my father used to say, well, you have a high rump. You can't shop there. It's your high rump. And I knew that I wasn't standard. But I also knew that all of my family members, all of the women in my family were strikingly gorgeous to me. The men in their lives appreciated their shape. So I didn't have that tension as much. So I don't know if it's better now, but what I do know is that there's always been this sort of over-sexualization of black women's bodies.
Yes.
And so in the workplace, and even at, you know, try to explain to my daughter why she can't wear the same thing as her friend. Mm. Because it doesn't look the same. You have a curve there, and she doesn't have a curve there. So you can't wear leggings like she can wear leggings. So it goes back to this idea that black women in our natural state are somehow wrong.
Okay, but Christine, one of the things that you talk about on the show, and it's worth bringing up now, you all talk at some point or another on the show about skin tones.
Mm-hmm.
And Christine, you talk on the show about your complexion, which is very light. You're very fair skinned.
Yeah.
And that's made a difference in your life, yes?
For sure. Even the fact that you just said I'm very fair skinned kind of made the skin on the hair on my
arm. But you said it yourself. You described yourself that way.
It's absolutely true. I, in my mind, for some reason, I have to be reminded that I am so fair, and that being fair, that people respond to me differently because I am fair.
And is it then harder to be a darker skinned black woman?
Yes. Not anymore.
Yes.
It is. See, we disagree. Because I think it depends on where you are in the world of work. Because, as I said, you two are in business for yourself. But when I just turn on television now, the trend has gone from women who look like me anchoring, and I have nothing against the women who are on. I'm just pointing out the fact. They all either look Hispanic or biracial. And if you find someone who is very dark, she is usually out in the field.
Ooh,
reporting.
That's not how that sounds.
No, I know, but she's out in the field reporting.
Right,
that's just
right,
as
right.
simple
I
as that.
I thought we were going
right.
to have a Bill Maher moment.
Oh, no. Right. No. But then you also, when I look at when people in other businesses, how the women get promoted, I oftentimes see the black woman who is a little bustier, a little darker, a little bigger, not getting that mentorship that another black woman is getting because she looks more like the manager who is thin and physically fit. And normally people are more comfortable with people who look like them. So I still see many women who are fairer, and particularly those with straight hair, who get more opportunities. Why do you think you see so many women getting hair weaves? Mm-hmm. Yes, you can get it because you just like it, but many of them do it because they think it will give them a leg
up
in the world of business.
But then I think about Viola Davis, and I think about Tiana Paris, who has the most glorious shock of Afro hair, and she walks red carpet looking authentically dark-skinned, chocolate, beautiful, with a big Afro. every day.
I think
about Danielle Brooks,
but Viola Davis.
She changes her hair for what she has to do.
The truth of the matter is that there is more space, more room opening up for brown, dark-skinned women. But there is a clear preference that men articulate, that you see in the media, that you see even when you just, if you surveyed the wives, if you surveyed the first wives and surveyed the
second wives
after the money, if you put them side by side,
yes.
the standard is a woman who looks less race specific.
Okay.
And not like their mother.
Okay. We have a few minutes before we have to take another break. I really want to address something. And in fact, Deneen, you wrote a book with this in the title. What is an angry black woman? What the heck is that? And what was the name of your book? You wrote it.
The Angry Black Woman's Guide to Life.
What does it mean to be an angry black woman? Because Monica said it to me on the phone the other day.
Right. So
if we don't do this right, you're going to have a bunch of angry black women.
You don't want none. You don't want none. So the book was a satire with me and two of my girlfriends. And we wrote it to poke fun at the idea that people stereotypically look at black women and assume that we're just going to black out or go off or lose our minds or cuss you out or do something wrong to you, your mama, your daddy, and your cousin too, if you don't do what we want you to do.
But I think that stereotype is perpetuated by a lot of the TV shows I see.
Mm-hmm.
With audiences that are participating in game shows and that sort of thing, where in fact there does seem to be an effort to encourage white people, black people to act in outrageous ways, and quite often that's the angry black woman. Am I making sense?
Well, but sometimes it can be a woman in the office who says to someone, you know, I really have a problem with you showing up late because your work then falls on my plate. It's time for you to do your job. And then that person runs off and says, I can't believe what she said to me.
Right. She's so angry.
She's so angry.
Right. So there have been studies that show that when a white woman is in a position with a psychiatrist and she results the same symptoms as feeling frustrated, depressed, sad, that she is diagnosed as having some sort of depressive issue. When black women present those same feelings, that they are emotionally imbalanced and somehow aggressive and angry and unrational, unreasonably emotional. And so there's this idea that black women, when we express ourselves, we are unreasonably emotional. And that, I think, is played higher when it comes to sort of being aggressive. I think all women experience this whole idea that if I do something, then I'm a bitch. We're all trying to sort of walk that line of not being the bitch because of the influences of sort of this sexism in our society.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have that same situation on a brown body, coming out of a brown mouth, it is more likely to be considered unreasonable, unrational, and imbalanced.
All right.
And uppity. I can remember touching Wes Sargent. But I can remember touching Wes Sargentson like this.
Anchorman.
The phones went off the hook saying, you don't know your place.
Your white anchor partner.
Yes.
Wow.
I don't know my place.
All right. We're going to break in a second. But I want to take the other side of the angry black woman and give you another quote. Ava DuVernay, the great, now one of the finest directors out there working in pictures. She did Selma, among other things. Here's what she said. Black girl magic is a rallying call of recognition. Embedded in the everyday is a magnificence that is so easy to miss because we're so mired in the struggle and what society says we are.
Mm.
What a wonderful affirmation.
Yes, yes.
On the other side of the angry black woman and the notion of the struggle. Yeah?
And the struggle continues. We all have daughters.
Yeah.
And we hope by the examples of the way we live our lives, we're showing them that they are people of value, they are people of worth, and they can be anything
they want to be. But as a club, the Black Woman Club,
mm-hmm.
do you embrace what Ava DuVernay is
Absolutely.
Talking about?
Absolutely. That's what I meant about seeing that wall, that line wall, and deciding I'm going to find my joy. I don't care what you think about me. I don't care what stereotype you have about me. I can find my joy following my culture, following the way that I choose to live, following the way that I choose to raise my children, how I love my man, how I enjoy, you know, life, that I'm finding my joy on my own, and I don't need your validation for that.
Okay, we've got to take a break. We're going to come back. We have a little time on the other side of the break, and we got to talk about the N-word. So we're going to do that.
You mean the nice word?
Yeah. This is Two-Way Street. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. We're talking to the women who, is Star okay? Star seems like such an
Oh, we're taking it.
Monica Kaufman, Christine White, and Deneen Millner, who star in the new GPB TV show, A Seat at the Table, which deals with the African-American, the female African-American experience. But we got to talk about the big experience, which is the N-word. Now, I have to tell you, and I want to ask you.
There is no two-way street with the word N, the N-word. There is no two-way street on the N-word. It's one way.
Well,
and that way is what we do in our homes, what we say to each other is strictly, but don't you say it. Even if you dance into a rap song with it in it, don't do it.
You will get your feelings hurt.
So talk about the word.
I think that Ice Cube said, interestingly enough, he said it really well in the past couple of weeks, that the word was venom. It was venom when it was used against us. Though it was used so readily, it was used so much that we took it on, maybe for good, maybe for bad. But over time, we've sort of changed the meaning. And it has become a word of endearment, even for when we are talking about each other. But it's a word of endearment because it signals a shared struggle. So when I say Martin to Martin, I am literally recognizing that we are in the same boat. When someone else who's not in that boat says it, they're using that struggle against us. And so then you automatically are identifying as not an ally, but an enemy.
Wow.
And so, you know, for me, I actually have incredible feelings of love and joy associated with the word.
And I don't. I really don't, because I was called it too much growing up.
Yeah, you grew up, in Louisville in a segregated town.
And my mother said, you don't ever use that word, although young people use it as a noun, a verb, and an adverb, and sometimes an adjective. But no, it to me is totally demeaning, insulting, and the hair on the back of my head stands up, and I just want to grab
somebody.
So
you don't
want to hear,
you don't like it when rappers,
I don't even like it when hip-hop artists use it.
Okay.
I find it derogatory.
And you two work in that industry and hear it all the time.
I kind of straddle the line. You know, I'm from New York, and I've been living here in Georgia for 12 years now. I never once had anybody call me that here. But in New York, it happened all the time. It was like a nickname. By the time we left there and we came down here, I would lock the doors and think, okay, if they could do that up north, what is going to happen when we get down to Georgia? But I've just never heard anybody refer to me that way. No one's ever talked to me in that kind of way here.
What bothers me about it is that people will use that word in a heartbeat with us. Mm-hmm. In a heartbeat.
Right.
But if we called you by the derogatory name that is used for someone in the Jewish faith, or an Italian, there would be all-out war.
Right.
And it's like people just feel like they can say it.
Right. Really?
Wait, and that drives me crazy.
Are you saying that You talked about, as a, in New York, people using that as a slur. Mm-hmm. Are you saying that there, you have white friends or you know white people who think it's okay to use that word, thinking it's okay?
Because until, they, yes.
Until I set really? Them straight.
Until you get sure. them straight. I can remember Claire, a longtime friend of hers, who she's even the godmother of their children. And she happened to be at their house. And she heard the young man describe someone he didn't know that Claire was in the next room and used the word, that N-word. Claire said she nearly went through the ceiling. And then when she walked in and confronted him on it, he turned red. They've been friends from the first grade. She has never heard him use that word. Mm. But it was comfortable to use it with other white people out of Claire's earshot, so he thought. I got cut off in traffic the other day by a lady, and I didn't do anything. She turned around because I didn't let her over as quickly as she thought and called me the N-word.
It's partially because there's been this huge backlash that says, we are in a post-racial society. There is no racism. White supremacy doesn't exist. And when, and it, so it's the little white mm-hmm. American lie. Yeah. It's the little white lie that says, I can say it in my circles with my white friends, but just don't let any black people hear you say it. Right. And so while black people are saying we see racism and we see white supremacy operating in the world every single day, and you, and not, you, the media, you, you know, the political regime try to make me feel like I am crazy to the point where I am like second guessing my whole existence, my whole experience. But then something happens and your preference for white supremacy, your white supremacist leanings, subconsciously even, come out. They come out a little bit with that word. And that's what we saw with Bill Maher. That's what we see when it even happens, you know, on college campus with kids who are, you know, trying to equal out the playing field. Well, if you can say it, why can't I say it? Mm-hmm. Because I live in an experience that you don't live in. That's
but of course, that's the excuse.
That's the excuse.
Yeah.
The excuse is, what are you talking about? Rappers, hip-hop artists, they use that word all the time, and you're telling me just because I'm white, I can't use that word?
Absolutely. Yes,
that's what we're saying.
You know, on the other side
it's like
that,
a curse word.
Okay, we're getting close to the end. Black role model. Black women role models. Who are they in your life?
My role model was my mom, who died last year, two days before my birthday, at the age of 93. Yeah. She was the first woman on both sides of my family to graduate from high school. She worked her way through a high school in New Orleans, Louisiana, by cleaning for the maids. She worked in the post office, married her childhood sweetheart. Then when he had an affair and left, she said, I can raise this child on my own, and took two and three jobs to make it do. But she was there for every part of my everything I was involved in. She always used to say to me, it's what you do with what you have that makes you what you are. Don't make excuses, make work. Hattie was ferocious. Even to the day she died, her whole lesson to Claire and me was, don't let anybody tell you who you are. You define who you are.
Hmm. Those of us who worked with you were very lucky that we got to know your mother.
Miss Hattie.
She was a remarkable woman. I want to close the show by reading you all something, and then just give you get a quick reaction. Maya Angelou, I can't think of a better way to close a show with three really smart, strong African-American women than quoting her. And I found a poem that I thought was really apropos of our conversation. Here's what she wrote. You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still like dust I'll rise. Out of the huts of history's shame, I rise up from a past that's rooted in pain. I rise, I'm a black ocean, leaping and wide, welling and swelling, I bear in the tide.
It, what little black girl does not have to recite that
in
front of every black woman she knows, in front of the church, in front of the deacons, in front of your grandmama.
Everybody.
I danced to that song at my eighth grade, and that poem at my eighth grade graduation to the sound of drums. Mm-hmm. These little pieces of pride and strength and growth and heritage that have been left by black women like Maya Angelou were so important in our development because there was so much contrary to that. So we had to hold on to every little bit of love and self-affirmation that we could get. I am welling and swelling. I bear in the tie.
All right. We are completely out of time. I will tell you, by the way, that when I saw that poem, I had no idea that was an iconic poem.
Oh, yes.
Black girls,
oh,
yeah. Wow.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. We're like, which one is he going to get?
There are so many of
them. Phenomenal Woman is
well,
the other one.
Look, Monica Pearson, Deneen Milner, and Christine White, A Seat at the Table premieres Sunday night. What time?
6:30.
You're on. And beyond the TV show, it was such a pleasure to get a chance to talk to all of you on Two-Way Street today. You're a great group, and you've taught me some things that I really needed to hear, and I hope our listeners feel the same way. So, and thanks to our audience
yes,
for being here
you.
For
Two-Way
Street.
Thank you for having
Street.
Us.